Welcome to the stream. I'm Ahmed Shahabuddin. Today we're discussing disasters and people with disabilities. Why is this community excluded from planning for emergencies? We're live on YouTube, so tell us your thoughts and join the discussion. More than a billion people worldwide live with a disability, and studies say they are 2 to 4 times more likely to die in a disaster. Experts say this is because most countries don't take their needs into account when formulating emergency plans. As climate change makes natural disasters more common and more damaging, things are changing. Many disabled communities around the world are getting more involved when it comes to handling emergencies. Take a listen as to why.
The group that is slated to be most impacted by climate change is disabled people. It will be us. Like everything else, it will impact us the most. And what's sad is that all these pre-planning ideas that people have around disasters and climate change and extreme weather events, they don't really apply to us. There are a lot of us that cannot evacuate. There are a lot of us that can't even get our meds in advance. And you want to set that extra 30 days worth? Everything that happens to our community, as always, is a policy decision. There are a lot of people that do not care that these things are devastating to our communities on a global scale.
Joining us to discuss today's topic, Anna Landre. She's a disability researcher based in London. We also have Erman Parodi. He's the co-executive director of the Partnership for Inclusive Disaster Strategies and is based in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And finally, welcome to Erin Brown. She's a disability inclusion consultant based in Nassau in the Bahamas. So much to discuss here. Anna, let's start with the basic, obvious, and important question. Why are people with disabilities disproportionately affected in the first place?
That's a great question. So what happens is that when planning for disasters, disaster planners often don't include disabled people in the spectrum of those who are going to be affected. Ableism positions our needs as too far outside the norm to be planned for. So you have this idea that disabled people are expected losses, that we're just not going to make it, that we're not even worth planning for. And that's a self-fulfilling prophecy, and that's why we see what we do with disabled people dying and being injured far more frequently.
Erin, does that resonate? I see you're nodding your head.
Ooh, and the statement alone just gave me chills because that is the absolute reality, and that's actually how we feel when we hear about the preparedness, the recovery, and the relief strategies that does not include our communities, our families. And we're sitting there saying to ourselves, do you want me to live through this disaster? So yes, I totally agree with Anna.
And Erman, I want to share with you, sort of for our audience at least, let's start with just outlining some of these numbers behind this issue. Take a look at this. According to the United Nations, 180 member states have ratified the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. 15% of the world's population, or more than 1 billion people, are living with a disability. Just to give you a sense of, you know, how much impact this has on people's lives. 80% of people with disabilities live in developing countries and, of course, are more vulnerable to climate change. And as we mentioned at the top, people with disabilities 2 to 4 times more likely to die in a disaster. Erman, I know that you and your colleagues deploy on the ground in Puerto Rico and elsewhere. I'm curious if you could share with us, you know, for our audience, just to bring to life what kind of work it is that you do when that happens.
Thank you, Ahmed, and to everyone listening, thank you for joining this conversation, which is very important to the future of us all. In disasters, our organization, the Partnership for Inclusive Disaster Strategies, reaches out to local disability-led organizations, like Erin Brown in the Bahamas, right after Dorian. In Puerto Rico, we reached out to and organizations around the world, many in the United States, called Centers for Independent Living, disability-led, focused on people with disabilities. We deployed after Maria to Puerto Rico and to the Bahamas after Dorian, connect with disability-led organizations, mutually connect with the ministries responsible for our welfare, and go out into the community with disability-led organizations.
And forgive me, Erman, I'm just wondering, when you're doing all this important work and all these collaborations, what are the biggest challenges? If you can share with us, what are the concerns that the community are highlighting to you or that you see?
Well, we go out together. That's part of it. Going out, seeing what is the true pain that is being left behind by the gap. People who are power dependent, people not getting their medications, people in the outskirts of the central areas not receiving services. We find that people with disabilities a lot are often forgotten from where the service deliveries will be. Oftentimes, right after the disaster, points of distributions are set up, mm-hmm. areas that people with disabilities often cannot get to. But even ahead of the storm, many did not hear of the alarms, did not know the disasters were coming, were not equipped to readily be prepared for the disasters. And afterwards, our needs, and Erin can share more, mm-hmm. our needs are forgotten. Mm-hmm. In the Bahamas after Dorian, months and months and months later, people that needed medication and insulin were not receiving it.
And I appreciate you kind of bringing it up that they're kind of not only not prioritized, but an afterthought, forgotten. Erin, I want to come to you, but before we do, I want to get in a comment that we have that was sent to us from Julia, a professor at Georgetown, kind of just framing this in a really powerful way. Take a listen.
Disabled people live in a world that wasn't built for us. We face ableism every day, whether that's inaccessible infrastructure, poor public transit, not enough sign language interpreters, intense poverty, the list goes on. When there's a natural disaster, those structural barriers become a matter of life and death. But the problem isn't disability. The problem is ableism. The problem is poor planning. Communities fail to center disability access in the best of times. And during disaster situations, that magnifies the inequality.
So that was Julia Belser, a professor at Georgetown University. She talked about structural barriers, and I saw Erin and Anna, both of you, nodding at the same time. I want to ask you, Erin, why did that resonate?
Yeah. Ooh, it resonated for many reasons. And one, it's a proud moment to hear other persons around the world amplifying the voices of our community with disabilities. As Human said during Dorian, what we recognized, the barriers were also the communication in the relief, finding out who still is available, who still have access, what are their needs. Even in the shelters, having accessible bathroom, being able to bring the additional equipment that you would need when you are going to a shelter. How do I get to the shelter? And so a lot of these things that you would have assumed to be built into the current system is not. And therefore, we have to continue to speak about the gaps, speak about the barriers that are not only just physical or infrastructural, but also systematic, because the procedures, the practices, the policies do not speak to access, inclusion, and opportunities for persons with disabilities during disaster or emergency.
And Anna, you know, when a disaster is about to strike, we're often told either to flee or to go find an emergency shelter, or to, you know, stock up on medical supplies and you know for as long as potentially 72 hours. I mean, how are those, you know, how are those instructions sort of failing the disabled community?
Yeah, well, I think we saw in, for example, New Orleans, Hurricane Katrina, where disabled people were left behind when the evacuation vehicles were not wheelchair accessible. And in fact, there's a really famous story in our community of a woman named Vanilda Caixeta who drowned because of this in her wheelchair. And this happens again and again. And it's not because these needs are impossible to provide for or too hard to manage in an emergency. Because as you hear, Herman is doing it. Erin is doing it. Mm-hmm. I am doing it in our work. But the difference is that we are disabled, that we know these needs. We know it like the back of our hand because mm-hmm. it's our lives. And the people making these policies, the people carrying out this work, are often not of that experience. And that's why we have these mistakes being made.
And on that note, I mean, beyond Erin echoing you, kind of, we have Griffin LLC here on YouTube chiming in saying, the lack of trust is a big one, too. As the panelists mentioned, many folks with disabilities have had such poor experiences, they don't expect much from responders. Edmund, I see that you're nodding. How do you see this play out when you're going around, on the ground in the street trying to help people after a disaster?
Right now, we are supporting disability-led response in Florida following Hurricane Ian. Mm-hmm. Today, this morning, through our disability and disaster hotline, we have been supporting now for 3 weeks, and specifically now, a woman with a disability who was kicked out of the shelter, county-run shelter. Everybody else was able to get some service. This is a wheelchair user now in the streets. We're working to get local support as we speak, but this happens again and again, that the systems leave us behind. Mm-hmm. And think about this is in the eastern side in Volusia of Florida. In the western side, in Fort Myers, hospitals right after Ian were telling people with disabilities, go back out, go into uninhabitable places where we needed to intervene, get people to safe hospital hotels with mm-hmm. wraparound services. This is a systematic problem not only in around the world, but happening in the United States, creating a mm-hmm. awful promising practice that's what they delineate as the example, leaving people with disabilities behind.
And Anna,
and I think this belies a wider trend, which is that, we have seen some improvement in the written rules about disability inclusion in disasters, in the laws, in the international standards, especially since 2015. We have seen more countries include disabled people in those written standards. The problem is that those often do not reach the ground. Mm-hmm. We're not seeing implementation of those. What we're seeing is people talking the talk about inclusion and mm-hmm. not saving lives when push comes to shove in a disaster.
And I appreciate you bringing that up for many reasons. I mean, I know that in 2015, the UN sort of made it more of their sort of a bigger part of their agenda, let's say. I'm curious how much progress we've actually made. But to give an example, I mean, when we talk about inclusion, we received a video comment from Fatin Tarawa, who is in Gaza, working and outlining how she works with children and what they do to prepare there. Let's take a listen, and then we'll come back to you.
We train them how to prepare their emergency kit to use in the emergency situation. Also, we train them to develop a plan in order to intervene and to interact and to deal with these situations. So everyone in the family members should have a role and should be know how to deal and how to, for example, evacuate children with disabilities. So we provide them with a mechanism of evacuation for children with disabilities. And after the emergency situation is ending, we visit and be in contact with those families to evaluate their situation during emergency and start building a new plan for the upcoming emergencies or the anything we expect it will be happen in the future.
I found it interesting what Fatin said there about the follow-up mm-hmm. visits and how that informs future planning. It seems like you all seem to agree that one of the problems is that the community itself is not included in the planning, and that if they were, not only would it, maybe be better for the community, for the disabled community, I should say, but also just better planning at large. I mean, Erman, I remember when I was on the ground during Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico, beyond being shocked by the sheer devastation, I remember on day two or three coming across a few people from the disabled community and being quite... Just reflecting, it was clear to me that there was huge gaps still. Those experiences for me really informed how serious a problem this is. I want to ask you, who's doing it right? I mean, I know Bangladesh, of course, which is notorious for horrific flooding, Anna, has new strategies that they're trying to implement. What can you share with us about a few success stories, where to look for how to proceed?
Well, I'll share Bangladesh quickly, and then I think Hidman will have a lot of other great ones. In Bangladesh, just as I'm forgetting her name, but the woman whose video just played in Gaza shared, they are also training community members on how to assist disabled members of the community in the event of a flood or a similar natural disaster, which are, of course, happening more and more often due to climate change. So you have this sense of training of what to do when disaster does strike, and you have some material gains and actions, like the fact that they're building and providing accessible evacuation boats for mm-hmm. people mm-hmm. with ramps that deploy onto the shore. So that's really great progress, and I bet Herman can share some other examples.
Herman?
Well, thank you, Anand. That's perfect example, but as you can understand, it's happening by local leadership in mm-hmm. small areas. You know, maybe with large reach, but the scope is small. I'm sure, remembering from Anna's conversations with Fight for Right, the Ukrainian disability-led organization we have been supporting to date, they have helped over 2,500 people evacuate and thousands more shelter in place. Mm-hmm. We just got 41 pallets of supplies there a couple weeks ago, and they're getting ready for needs for the winter coming. Fight for Right is doing it right, and together we're pushing across different humanitarian sectors. In Puerto Rico, following Hurricane Maria, there was a lot of work with the disability community, and in the 2020 earthquakes, mm-hmm. there was a lot more rescue focused on people with disabilities, and the news was also seen now after Hurricane Fiona. But this is at the moment, and it's small in target. As you explained at the beginning, mm-hmm. people with disabilities are about 1 billion, 15% yeah. of the global population. Yes. We need to target this now.
And
COVID, COVID left too many people with disabilities dead.
Right.
And it affected us most.
And Herman, go ahead.
To focus.
Yeah.
Sorry, just that it just needs to be recognized. People with disabilities are the most impacted. And governments, ministries, and the social networks need to work together to figure this out, or we won't find a future where we exist.
Right.
Aaron, go ahead. Yeah.
Aman, you said it so well. And one of the terms that you use that persons really need to hold on to, disability-led organizations. What I love about Fatima, she brought the family aspect into mm-hmm, it. Mm-hmm. Because for me, I'm a mother with a disability. I am an above-the-knee amputee, so I can use a wheelchair, crutches, or a prosthetic leg. Mm-hmm. And when it was time to have to go into a shelter, I had to make a decision if I was going to take my child with me, because for most families with disabilities, the shelter does not have the capacity to take the entire family. Mm. And so here in the Bahamas, we're also looking at ways of registering. So some of our impactful ways right now, because data collection and disaggregated data is absolutely important. And so registering persons with disabilities, helping to build that trust, because if I don't trust the system, I'm not going to register. I'm not going to let you know what my equitable needs are in order for you to provide it. And then also providing a hotline. Mm-hmm. As Herman said, there is a disability hotline that the partnership provides globally for mm-hmm. anyone to use. And so what Aaron Brown Connects did in the Bahamas is we created one nationally. And so persons, whether you are deaf, blind, hard of hearing, neurodiverse, and you need to get in contact with social services or any other support, you're able to use our WhatsApp hotline number, as well as calling it directly or mm-hmm. just texting mm-hmm. in order to be the most accessible for you to get what you need during emergencies and disasters.
Right. And I appreciate you highlighting, I really do appreciate you highlighting the importance of registration. I mean, these things can seem simple and yet really fundamental to actually addressing the issues. With that in mind, because we were talking about inclusion, we keep coming back to the marginalized, beyond the disabled community. It seems that, you know, we have a video comment that highlights sort of the compounded impact of what happens if you're both from the disabled community and further marginalized within society. Take a listen to what Michael Yackey had to say, a commissioner at the United States Commission on Civil Rights. Take a listen.
Our reports show that if you were black, if you were brown, if you were low income, your ability to receive the same type of aid that a white person from or a more affluent community could receive was very compromised. But if you were disabled, if you were deaf, if you had a physical condition that required medication in the aftermath of a disaster, that's when things really went downhill. And people with disabilities are the most vulnerable community after any natural disaster.
So he was, commenting on this report that he had worked on. This is, of course, after the hurricanes and Harvey and Maria. But I'm curious, Anna, when you heard him sort of talk about that. Did it help you, or how can we take away from this conversation how to address that specific problem moving forward, not just in the U.S., but around the world?
Yeah, I think it shows that the solutions to these problems are going to be grassroots, and they're going to mean listening to the people affected. Because the people affected don't exist along these clean lines of, are you disabled, or are you a woman, or are you black, or are you brown? We all exist at an intersection of a lot of these identities, whatever they may be. And I think Hirvan and Erin and I keep saying, you know, disability-led. And that means leading from all these other marginalized groups as well. I mean, disability is far more common in these multi-marginalized communities, in black and brown communities, poor communities. So you're going to find that if you want to include disabled people, you have to include all disabled people at the intersection of these needs.
Right. And, you know, we all...
I love it.
I love it.
Yeah, I love that you spoke about intersectionality, because even the migrants, he didn't say migrants, but migrants with disabilities are also heavily impacted during disasters and emergencies.
And what I was going to say is, you know, we shouldn't think that people with disabilities are only, you know, mobility issues. Actually, let's take a listen to what this human rights lawyer, Lucia Kula, had to say. She sent us this video from London. Take a listen.
How we talk about disability and our basic understanding of disability needs to shift. In most cases, we consider disabilities around mobility impairment, but we know, of course, that disability have more to do than just with mobility issues. So not only does the language need to change, but also the people who are involved in spaces creating policies and laws that particularly affect those mostly marginalized need to understand that when those people are not included in the room, oftentimes policies are not able to target at the root issue.
Erman, I'm curious your reaction to that comment, but also what would you want our audience to know before we wrap up the conversation for today?
That's such a point. We need to prepare cross disability, not just physical, and I am a wheelchair user myself, but all disabilities, psychosocial, sensorial, and bring all of our needs in the preparedness, planning, development. Take away, involve yourself in emergency management at any level. Begin developing in your communities, in your household, with your friends, a culture of preparedness. Climate change is here, disasters are increasing. Every person prepared by themselves and with the community and with their systems will make a safer future for us all.
Yes, yes. And if I can add to that,
quickly,
in our risk reduction plan, we also need to recognize that chronic illnesses is inclusive of persons with disabilities as well. So whether you have sickle cell, you may have diabetes, you may have any type of spinal injuries, multiple cirrhosis, all of these things include you into our spaces, even pregnant women. Pregnant women, we also have to consider in disaster and emergencies. Are we making sure that everyone is involved, have access to, and is included in the planning?
And on that note, I do want to thank you all for being such great leaders today and helping us navigate this topic. Anna, before I let you all go, I want to congratulate you. This tweet where you talk about, you know, having made it to the Shaw Trust Disability Power 100 list just after having moved to the UK. We're proud of you, and thank you for taking the time again, Anna, Erman, and Erin, to be on the show. Yes, it's important for visibility, but also... you know, that we are able to hold the people making decisions accountable. And for those of you tuning in, remember, here at The Stream, the conversation always continues. You can follow us online at AJ Stream.